In our first talk, I said that as time and condition permitted, we would also go a little further into anecdotes about General Albert Pike, and perhaps one that would be of interest is rather an evidence of his literary skill, his power of expression, and something of the inner poetry of the man, which made it possible for him to be so faithful an interpreter of works themselves, deeply and reverently poetic. The particular fragment that I want to read is taken from a letter, and by nature and circumstances of the letter is important. Early in 1891, one of General Pike's very close friends passed on, one whom he regarded with peculiar and profound affection. And in conformity with the practices of the Masonic Order, when an active member of the 33rd degree passes on, it was customary to send certain announcements and instructions to the various Masonic bodies. This is the subject of the particular letter, which is written in the Orient of Washington, District of Columbia, the 10th day of March, 1891. Unto the bodies and brethren of our obedience, shalom, which means, as I said last week, peace. Shalom, peace, that comes with blessing to care, fretted, weary men, when death's dreamless sleep ends all suffering and sorrow. Because it may be that after a little while, long illness will cause total disability, I must endeavor to perform with feeble hand and confused mind this pious duty to the memory of one who was my dearest friend and whose death is my infinite loss and deprivation irreparable. A little later he adds, the poet Holmes compares an old man to one who, in company with a few friends, clings to a spar floating in mid-ocean. From it, one after another, weakened in and weary of the struggle of life, drops off into the sea, wherein is no trace of what has been, nor foreshadow of what may come, until at last only one survives, and with the illimitable sea around and under him, and the illimitable sky above him, he is the loneliest creature that lives in all the world. It is a cruel blow of ill fortune when one, who in his old age counts the years of his life by their losses, is suddenly thus bereft of another of his few remaining companions and friends. For to live in the joy that is past, of companionship and good offices, is to live in the remembrance of a dream that faints and fades away, and there is no hope of any new joy of light companionship to come. The letter is signed by General Pike, and 3 weeks after he wrote it, he died. It is his last official document to the Masonic Order. But I think the spirit of it shows something of the extraordinary gentleness and deepness of the man, and of his wonderful power to express, even when himself in his last illness, his thoughts and his solicitudes to the family and associates of his departed brother. One of the last pictures of General Pike is this one, taken probably about 1884. He is shown wearing the decoration that was bestowed upon him by King Kalakua of Hawaii. Here is the last picture, I think, also, that was taken of General Pike. He is certainly one of those men who may be regarded as a birth out of time. He belonged to a very gentle, classical way of life that has almost entirely disappeared from among us. So we have another little episode in his life, and as time goes on, we will try to bring in others. But I think for the reason of the weight of our subject tonight, that we should proceed with our major trend. Many friends and those interested are aware that Freemasonry contains certain symbolic teachings and ideas, and that in particular the Scottish degrees, so named for some peculiar reason because they originated in France, this particular group of degrees is involved in a long and panoramic analysis and study of the great symbolisms and teachings of the world, in an effort, so to say, to restore in the mind of the beholder something of the long and wonderful tradition of human effort and human achievement. We have already said that General Pike was one of the earliest American students of the Zen language, and also a great student of Sanskrit. Early in his researches, he came to certain conclusions about the origin of Indian culture, and he was deeply and strongly influenced by the Zarathustrian religion. Because of this deep interest, fragments from his researches are to be found in the liturgies and legendas of the rites, and in every instance they are treated with the greatest dignity and solemnity. He was one of the early scholars who, in the study of Indic tradition, was deeply impressed by the importance of the early Iranian contribution to the great flowering of Indian culture. And I think the fact that he made his own translations of the Zendavesta and many other of the Persian sacred and classical writings, and also an original translation of most of the Mahabharata and the Institutes of Manu, that we see he was a serious person, and that his vision in this matter should be as advanced and contemporary as it is rather surprising when we realize that in his day there was very little work in this field in the United States. Yet the book with which we are concerned, and from which we will make a few quotations to show the spirit of his researches, was first published in 1871, so that we realize that he was quite a pioneer in this particular field. We may not be inclined to associate Masonic scholarship with these matters, but as we go further, we will realize that Masonry did produce a number of very good scholars, such as Gould, Mackey, Oliver, and Pike. All of these men were students of comparative religion. Each one of them, from his own particular facet, his own approach to the broad field, was convinced of its essential importance. Each of these men also was basically an idealist. He believed in values, he believed in religion, he believed in the spiritual life of man. And this dedication also reveals itself through the things that he wrote and said. Now, it is impossible, in a manner which is entirely satisfactory, in as brief a survey as we can make of the general pattern, to involve ourselves in all of the bypaths into which the general traveled and explored along his way of thought. I've noticed that in 4 or 5 pages, for example, he will make fairly elaborate references to 7 or 8 different religious systems with certain specific details. This becomes a little too complicated for our present purpose, so that it will be necessary to try to find out certain of his basic opinions and teachings and feelings on this important subject. In the first place, then, Pike was among those who believed definitely in an early migration of peoples from northwestern Asia into what is now called the Indo-Gangetic Plain. He believed that these people brought with them a tremendous wealth of literature, in the sense not so much of books as of traditions, and root material from which a great literature could gradually develop and unfold. In other words, they brought the ideas. They brought the teachings of something, and that is one of the things that General Pike was very interested in discovering, if possible, what they did bring, and why and how they came to bring it. He therefore enters into a discussion of what are called the early Ayas, or peoples of the region, and Pike comes to the conclusion that the term Aya, meaning apparently the selected, or the anointed, or the set apart, or they're placed in some unique and holy condition for things to come, that this term was not strictly applicable to a race, and that we have therefore made a certain mistake, he feels, I'm speaking from his point of view, that we have made a mistake in assuming that the fact that these people were called the Ayahs makes it follow inevitably that they were exclusively what we call Aryan Hindus. He did not believe that such was the case. He held rather that this term covered a group of values and factors moving into Northern Asia over a considerable period of time, consisting of tribes probably from the Trans-Himalayas and the northern parts of that region, plus Turanian peoples and Iranian peoples, and that all these together more or less have come in popular mythology to be confused into a race, when really they were a group or a cycle of migrations moving in and all having a certain sacredness about them, which was responsible for the term of the Ayahs, and that this sacredness was in all probabilities bestowed upon them at a somewhat later date, so that the original designation is not contemporary with the migrations of the peoples. This brings another interesting point, which he feels has a bearing upon our situation. If these migrations took place over a considerable period of time, a strange and remarkable alchemy or chemistry results merely from the circumstance of timing. Time becomes terribly important as a means of modifying certain conditions and circumstances. A people, for example, moving from one area into another in ancient times, carried practically their entire culture with them. Once they had made a long migration, it was unlikely they would ever return to the original place. It was unlikely that they would even make any effort to communicate with it, because they carried with them their own total life. Thus, they would center into a new locality, perhaps climatically different, inhabited probably, as in the case of India, by earlier peoples, still functioning, particularly the Dravidian culture. And these people settling and remaining for a length of time and becoming accustomed to and acclimated to a certain region, gradually modified their own culture through contact with other peoples and with the gradual disappearance of their own immediate contact with earlier heritage. Thus they became a comparatively new people in a new area, but they also contained within their tribal tradition and national existence the roots of their beginnings and the great mythologies, legends, and convictions which moved them. If 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years later, another migration, perhaps, arising from almost the same source as the first, should then move downward and come into this area, these two people with one origin and one root and one source would meet as strangers because of the difference of cultural interval, because of new interests, new activities arising, and these would no longer recognize their kinship with each other. The new peoples would have made certain modifications in their beliefs, in their doctrines, in their ideas, and might very well have been somewhat influenced by the tribes and groups into whose environment they came. Gradually, therefore, from similar sources or from almost identical beginnings, through waves of migration, strong cultural differences could come into existence, gain certain authority and validity, and result in distantly related peoples meeting as total strangers, even though perhaps in their origin such was not the case. Pike is then concerned a little bit with what these people brought, and why it was to play so important a part in the cultural life of our race. Why was not the heritage from somewhere else more important? How did it happen that so many great streams of doctrine have come into existence and died? And why is it that one with a very strange and remote background should have become so extremely powerful and had such a lasting and enduring existence? General Pike in Morals and Dogma also points out that we have little, if any, appreciation of the actual magnitude of the influence that began in the Trans-Himalayas, that it represents far more than we will perhaps ever be able to recognize. that it not only influenced Asia and the Near East, but has influenced practically every culture on the face of the earth, that it continued to migrate and move, changing words and names, but not necessarily losing philological identities, because underneath various words and terms in Germanic, in Slavic, even in the Latin and Greek languages, in the Hebrew, and in the dialects of the North, Central, and South American Indians, we find definite kinships with the root words and root ideas of Northern Asia. Therefore, we can say with reasonable certainty in his thinking that there is practically no religion, no philosophy, and no science known to man which has not in some way been strengthened, encouraged, motivated, propelled forward, enriched by this original power that came from North Asia. Recognizing, therefore, that Asia seems to have conferred an impulse upon the whole world, Pike comes to the inevitable conclusion that there was something profoundly important, something undeniably forceful, something which man himself simply refused to permit to die. Man refused to depart from it. And by another strange and amazing circumstance, man was never able to outgrow it. He was never able to find that he could cast it aside as something no longer vital, necessary, or useful to him. Although Pike did not live in the days of Freud, Adler, and Jung, he did experiment with the psychological factor in thinking. He became convinced, therefore, that the great stream, which in some places he, with some apology, simply calls together the Veda, that this great stream undoubtedly flows not only through the world, as he says, like the seven sacred rivers of the Punjab. He also says that it flows through the living fabric of human consciousness. That in some way, this ancient lore, this old doctrine, arose from some extraordinary degree of integrity within man. That man, therefore, comes back to it when he is at his best, and departs from it only when he is at his worst. That in some mysterious way, when securities, prosperities, and indifferences dominate him, he forgets the law. But in his emergency, he returns to it, and is comforted by thought which the East has put into words, but which Western man has sort of felt in his soul, that whenever virtue should fail upon the earth, the law again would come forth. That this something, therefore, is essentially part of the total psychology of man, and that no other stream of lore, no other great symbolic structure of belief has touched man so deeply, held his consciousness so firmly, or required such periodic restatement in order that man himself might keep faith with himself. And from the time in which Pike lived, and from the general attitudes of the day, I think his position in this was that of a very liberal and sincere man, with a deep appreciation of values. Concerning the entire problem further, Pike goes back still beyond this, and he divides the concept of man concerning the origin of sacred things into two essential schools of belief. One is the belief that man is strengthened or ordained in the beginning of his existence by revelation. In other words, that at the root of the great spiritual tradition of the race, which he identifies always with this great Eastern complex of motions, that this motion began, as mythology or legendary or lore would seem to sustain, by the pronouncements of sacred persons whose individualities and personalities are really beyond our understanding, and whose existence is so shadowy that we can scarcely delineate it. Therefore, there is the belief that certain beliefs, certain doctrines, certain systems have endurance, have inevitability and infallibility because they are revealed by God to prophets, to teachers, to messiahs, to patriarchs, and that this great motion of peoples carried with it, from its root land, a divine revelation, a revelation apart, a revelation to which the people and their descendants continually rededicated themselves, a revelation which in good times was strong and in poor times was weak, a revelation frequently confused and corrupted, but ever rising phoenix-like from the ashes of its own dead. This concept that these things came from an independent source, from a source beyond and above man, came by way of mediators, came by way of persons who through one circumstance or another were brought like Moses or Zoroaster into the presence of the Most High and received the direct word of truth from those roots and sources which human beings normally cannot approach and nor can they fully comprehend. Then Pike points out that there is a second line of tradition that also must be given a certain amount of weight, namely that man's spiritual insight arises not from revelation, but from insight within himself, which is the root of a kind of revelation. In other words, that the human being is actually releasing through his own nature that God quality within himself, that power of internal, veritable cognition by which man causes his doctrines, his philosophies, his religions, his arts, and his sciences to come forth out of himself. That in coming forth out of himself, and therefore not following the theological structure of revelation, should not be regarded as conflict. It would only be regarded as an effort to understand the working of the one supreme power at the root of existence. Whether this working is from the sky, or from strange supernatural beings, or whether this working is outward through creation itself, Pike, I think, is inclined somewhat to value the second point of view. He believes that the gods working in the roots of time work not upon but through men, and that from the earliest time man's search for light was always the effort to release his own godhood, a spontaneous divine power within himself that would not and could not be repressed. And that therefore true revelation was also insight, and insight was revelation. And these two cannot be completely separated. For the internal life of man shares the eternity of all other things. And whether we regard this revelation as coming from the furthermost or from the innermost, either way we regard it, it is the same thing. Therefore, there is no need to say that insight or growth by experience is less sacred as a source of tradition or a source of valid knowledge than revelation itself. One, things are revealed to man by the other. Man reveals things through himself and they become known to himself. This situation then led Pike to the beginning of his study of the great symbolic processes which he sensed at the root of these great teachings. Being by instinct and nature, as his rituals and his writings and his interpretations imply, a symbolist, a person who believed tremendously in the integrating and releasing power of symbolic form, Pike presented himself with this equation. He presented himself with man standing as an aboriginal being upon the surface of the earth, surrounded by stars, mountains, valleys, beholding everywhere the infinite workings of universal law. Man stood like a newborn child with eyes first opening, perceiving all things with the first natural emotion of his kind, wonder. Nothing seemed natural. Nothing seemed commonplace. Nothing was ordinary. And yet, by the very wonder of it all, and by his own childishness, nothing was extraordinary. The ordinary and the extraordinary were one. The wonderful and the real were not divided. Man contemplated the mysteries of existence without the kind of awe that we know, but with the wondering insight of childhood. He did not have the false indication or inclination to bow down and venerate. Like the small child, he had only the inclination to accept, the inclination to reach out his hands to the sun, reach out his hands to the moon. The distances meant nothing to his primordial thinking. The stars were only what they seemed to be. But whatever they were wonderful. And most of all, this wonder gradually focused itself upon those things nearest to man. The wonders of the sky, of the heavens, of the seasons, the strange mysteries of existence, the storms, the lightning, and the thunders, all the mysterious flames that rose in the sky from the great blazing altar of Agni, all these things became one group of wonders. But these wonders were so superior, so aloof, so strange and universal in themselves, that man did not immediately feel the need to examine them. Perhaps he lacked the audacity of modern man, who will examine anything, whether he discovers anything reasonable or not, he will continue to examine. But man then, by nature of his own existence and by his own circumstances, began to experience other wonders. And some of these wonders that he experienced were not so wonderful. They were, many of them, terrifying. The sky normally did not terrify him unless a great storm moved across it. But the animal terrified him. The strange gleaming eyes of night, representing some beast waiting, this terrified him. The individual was also perturbed and concerned by certain things that he beheld happening to himself. He experienced the mystery of birth. He saw childhood and youth. He saw maturity and age. He saw decrepitude and death. These things came directly to himself. He experienced pain. He began to feel the pang of loss. He began within his own strange, simple nature to gather up heaps of stones or pebbles or shells or bright rocks and say, "These are mine." Then somebody else would take them away from him. And slowly, the wonders of the heavens remained a strange palace of gods beyond, but the wonders of the earth became a source of concern, a certain fretfulness, a certain disillusionment. Man began to sense that in this great world of wonders, he was curiously and strangely weak, that he seemed separate from great things and bound to small ones, that he had to fight the problems of hunger and shelter, and he had to grope his way to the mystery of fire. He had to learn to defend himself. He had to learn so many lessons that little by little a division took place in his psychology, in his thinking. He divided life into two things, what we might term theoretical and practical. There was no division, actually, but theoretical things were grandeurs that did not directly touch him. Practical things were infirmities that he had to face every day. And in spite of everything, we see it in children growing around us. This division takes place. And by this very division, General Pike points out, the gods inevitably began to retire to the sky because they were not quite available when man needed them here. The gods, the greatnesses, the great powers, became less and less immediately accessible to man. He did try to recognize their values and their powers, but still, in spite of all his offerings, in spite of all his prayers, in spite of all his acceptances and his rejections, life came and life went. Over these strange inevitables, therefore, it seemed that even the gods had not control. And the believer and the unbeliever came finally to the common grave. Out of these situations, these modifications, another important factor seemed to arise in the early consciousness of these ancestral peoples, and that particularly had to do with the linking of heaven and earth. And in the early linking of heaven and earth, man, not yet thoroughly aware of value, inclined like the primitive American Aborigine of the poem to see God in fire and hear him in the wines, this primitive man, began to pray, began to ask, began to beseech, sought ways of turning in some mysterious manner to the All-Father, who his instinct told him he needed. And he turned to this great world around him in search for parent, in search for that to which he could confide, that which would understand, that which had the strength and power to make all things right out of its own inevitable sufficiency. And out of the contemplation of stars and planets and rivers and seas, and out of man's common need, and out of his turning his eyes from his need toward the source of his help, slowly, as General Pike tells us, the strange, dim, but inevitable image of deity arose. Arose because man inwardly experienced it. Rose because he could cast the shadow of his own dreams upon the clouds. Rose because he demanded it, invoked it by the strangest and most subtle magic of all, the magic of necessity. And so, by degrees, the individual began to change the world, changing the world into mine and not mine, into heaven, earth, and hell, into wisdom and ignorance, into hate and love, and to all these polarizations with which we have gradually come to be familiar. Because this process was strangely natural, because there was about it this integrity that we do not appreciate perhaps in our confused time, it might be well to draw an analogy or take an example that would tell us something of what we mean. Suppose we say that a child born into this world was born into an absolutely natural environment. An environment in which there were no false values. An environment in which everything was honest. Honest in its own strange, mysterious, inevitable honesty. The honesty of a truth or a fact uncorrupted. And that this child, growing up in this world of facts, in which there were no myths, no legends, and no law, a child growing up building its life entirely out of only the sense of its internal need and perhaps the very dim and distant paternal help of a great believing parent who led that child only in gentle ways. If such a child, so brought up, so given opportunity, its life not deranged or disarranged in any way by the prejudices and intemperances of a highly complicated society, this child might grow up to be an honest person. It's quite conceivable that this child would have that kind of a beginning that psychologists like to talk about, at that wonderful, normal background. Well, perhaps, as Pike points out, the reason why the light of life has come from the ages is because in some mysterious way these progenitors, these first uninvolved peoples, these peoples that have not yet learned to hate, these people who lived close to reality, that in some way they are the basis of the strength that we possess. They were the ones who grew up in a reality, a factuality that we no longer have. And because of this childlike honesty with which they face life, they have left the imperishable monuments to us, because they were the only ones who were able to leave tradition before they were spoiled themselves. Later, they were spoiled, but in the root of things, they were not. And therefore, in their infancy, in their childishness, God walked with them. and because they were all wonder and all believing, because they used only the simple faculties of primordial creatures, they saw true, they dreamed true, and they came so close to reality that they have left us simple guides and rules, and what we call progress is our own eternal effort to be as simple as they were, to rediscover the directness of something which we have lost. Perhaps this is the reason why the light of the Vedas shone upon the world, why it is beneath everything, why it has come down to us in 100 religions, simply because it represents the simple light of the beholder, in which light and the eye and the heart responded together, and that there was no deceit, no confusion, no prejudice by which the mind and the emotions could be led into error. Perhaps for another example, we might pause for a moment and contemplate the effort of Gautama Buddha to restore this situation. Pike has many things to say about this. We're not here today or this evening to compare Buddhism and ancient Aryan Hinduism, but we are only trying to make a point, namely the point that we brought out last week, this mysterious power of essential cognition, that the only way to see truth is to see without preconception. The only way to intuit truly is this mysterious quietude which we must cultivate, by means of which we can truly be still and know. So Buddha says that if all of the volition of the will, all of the pressure of the machine of the sensory perceptions is brought into an absolute suspension, man then is no longer a seer. He is himself the total of the thing seeing and the thing seen without division. In this situation, he cannot be deceived, because no man can be deceived who does not first deceive himself. Thus, these primitive people, not being smart enough to deceive themselves, have left us a heritage relatively free of deceit. There may be many other explanations, but because of the situation we have, perhaps that is far enough in the general's thinking to show that particular phase of his mind and how he attempted to work with these problems. In his study, therefore, Pike first establishes what he might term or considers to be one of the most primitive and valid forms of human worship, and that is what he calls the worship of nature. He tells us that these ancient peoples, because of their peculiar insight, did not see nature as we do. We see nature as body. Ancient man saw nature as soul or life. We see nature as procreation. He saw it as psychic generation. We see nature as an arena or area of confused action. He saw nature as a field of eternal motion. To him, therefore, the worship of nature did not mean that he bowed down to any ordinary weed or spear of grass that came along. Rather, man sought for and found the psychic life of nature. He saw nature as soul moving through body. He saw nature as a kind of wonderful living entity. And early in his thinking, he came to the inevitable conclusion that nature was just as much alive as he was, that he was not a living thing in a dead world. He was not merely an animate being in a mechanistic a machine of some kind. It never occurred to ancient man that the bear or the lion or the bird had any different basic attitudes upon life from his own. Therefore, in many instances, we find among these people the tendency to create legends and lore in which they humanize animals, even as Aesop did much later, and still later, Fontaine. And therefore, we assume, for instance, we know the North American Indian of our northwest, up around the Vancouver area. When he went hunting in the woods, he talked to the bear. When the Indian of the plain killed a buffalo, he made a ceremony, smoked the pipe of peace to the soul of the buffalo, sat down and talked with it, just as you would with another person, explaining that he was not out hunting because he wanted to kill something, but because he had to live, and therefore that he really sincerely hoped that his need would be understood, and sometime, if by transmigration he should become a buffalo, he would be perfectly willing to let a hunter kill him for the same reason. They had a really heart-to-heart talk about this thing, because it did not occur to this man that the world was different from himself. He did not believe that trees could not understand. He did not believe that rocks were dumb. Like Pythagoras, he spoke to the river, and the stream answered him. Ancient man lived, therefore, in a world of life, not in a world of death. He lived in a world in which he beheld around him all kinds of differentiated life. He beheld also within himself faculties and powers in which many attributes seemed to be united and brought together in his own more complex personality. At first, however, of course, this was not particularly meaningful to him. But the main point we wish to bring to attention is this concept of nature worship, that man found the objects of his adoration in the processes around him. He found many reasons to gradually transform his wonder into veneration. He began to venerate those things which seemed to him good. He began to fear those things which seemed to have some evil implication to himself. And out of this process of nature, and from his own perspective, he came to the inevitable conclusion that some things were better for him than other things, that some things seemed to serve him, others to offend him. And out of this, in turn, came a rudimentary concept of good and bad. And this, projected against the great starlit sky of night, also resulted in the gradual recognition of the suras and asuras, the gods and demons, the great good spirits and the evil spirits. And just as in his own world there was the conflict of good and evil, so war began in heaven. And all the different problems that he faced, he saw parallels for in the world around him. Gradually, his unfolding faculties, investigating things, to point out one of the ancient adages, that the more he saw, the more completely he became frightened. While he accepted without question, he was at peace. The moment he questioned, he found proof for questioning. Whatever he looked for, he found. And in this seeking and finding, good and bad, simple doctrines and simple ideas gradually became more and more involved, until out of them the ages have produced most complicated theological systems. Primitive man, Pike tells us without reservation, as we have said, regarded the world as alive. Plato refers to it as the holy animal crawling through the sky. Ancient peoples, some felt that the world was a great turtle, others that it was an elephant standing on a turtle's back. But whatever they thought it was alive. It was the body of a great being. This great being was, in a way, the composite symbol extended from themselves. And this great being, which was the world, became gradually also the visible symbol of the invisible power of God. And as man is a soul in a body, so God is a soul in a world. And that this world's soul, therefore, like the human soul, sustained and supported this body. Man beheld himself growing and failing. He saw youth and age, and he therefore contemplated the great procession of the ages. He contemplated the birth and death of worlds. He applied all these ideas of his own experience to the universe. And out of his own experiencing, he fashioned by degrees the ideas that were to be great and wonderful to him. And in the course of his time, and in the way he lived, the universe divided into really three parts. One part was heaven, the great vault of Indra. the sky. The great being whose body was filled with countless eyes. This tremendous and wonderful God, the God of the firmament, the God that was the ancient God, like the Shanti of China, the old one. And in the course of his time, just as this God slowly disappeared under the conditioning attributes of man's own investigation, so little by little, the great old God, though not forgotten, though not denied, passed generally out of our common apprehension. It was no longer enough that simply the great sky God was there. This deity began to express itself through its progeny, through specialized and specific attributes, qualities, and appearances rising out of itself. And just as in most religions a messiah has gradually taken the place of the original deity, so somewhere along the path of this great migration of peoples, the great old God sort of retired, regained new interpretations, was given new appearances, was fitted into other faiths, many of his attributes remaining. But the one attribute which he originally possessed was gone, and that was totality. Instead of totality, man recognizing that unity is never divided, but that division takes place within it, in the process of division, man loses sight of the unity. Therefore, it was, according to Pike, at a very ancient time, it is said that the great God became more or less a martyr, was disfigured, took upon himself sackcloth and ashes, concealed himself in the body of the world, and was then known only from his appearances in the world. And as Uranus, the great god of the Greeks, was defamed, injured, afflicted, mutilated by those who sought to steal his empire, so the great father deity of the Aryas was gradually obscured, until he appears again only as the eternal penitent, the eternal mendicant, the one who must bear the burden, the sin, and the misery of all things. Then in his own place come forth the things out of himself, and they take dominion over him. For once in the great Nordic land there was a one-eyed giant by the name of Ymir. This great giant ruled alone and forever in Gnungagap, the great gap in space. And then there came forth from the body of this great giant its own offspring or progeny, and they turned upon it and slew it, and from it they made the world. Now this, in a sense, is something that Pike feels sure that this particular story originated in Asia. He feels so because, to him, it is the perfect explanation of the peculiar situation in which the Hindu deity Brahma has become involved in the course of time. Namely, that while still recognized with certain definite veneration, it is also true that this deity is valued, is important, is conceived as great, somewhat in a different or mysterious way. For it is his own son that brings him back into life and light again. He is the victim, or he is the sufferer, who is redeemed by his own son Vishnu. And it is only through the will and love of Vishnu that Brahma is again born. And is born, of course, upon the lotus blossom, while Vishnu sleeps upon the serpent of eternity. And Pike has something to say about this, which I think is important. And it's interesting to us, because of the time, as I say, in which it was done, in comparison to the tremendous amount of literature that we have today. Part of this, incidentally, will be interesting because it represents Pike's original translation of sections of the Bhagavad Gita. He tells us, as Rama, the epic hero, armed with sword, club, and arrows, the prototype of Hercules and Mithras, he wrestles like the Hebrew patriarch with the powers of darkness. As Krishna Govinda, the divine shepherd, he is the messenger of peace, overmastering the world by music and love. Under the human form, he never ceases to be the supreme being. The foolish, he says in the Gita, unacquainted with my supreme nature, despise me in this human form. While men of great minds, enlightened by the divine principle within them, acknowledge me as incorruptible and before all things, and serve me with undivided heart. I am not recognized by all, he says again, because concealed by the supernatural power which is in me. Yet to me are known all things past, present, and to come. I existed before Manu. I am the Most High God, the Creator of the world. And although in my own nature I am exempt from liability to birth and death, and am Lord of all created things, yet as often as in the world virtue is enfeebled, and vice and injustice prevail, so often do I become manifest, and am revealed from age to age, to save the just, to destroy the guilty, and to reassure the faltering steps of virtue. He who acknowledgeth me as even so, doth not in quitting this mortal frame enter into another, for he entereth into me. And many who have trusted in me and have already entered into me, being purified by the power of wisdom, I help those who walk in my path, even as they serve me. This he then explains in the sense that the great deity, the great simple collective unit power, the inevitable, the unmovable, the unchangeable, the essence of all things, that which is both being and becoming, this being was originally held under the symbolism of sky. It was held also under the alternating symbolism of day and night sky. And it was held in a mysterious way that night revealed the splendor of the sky even more than did the day. Therefore, the sky and day was obvious or evident. The sky and night was a host of gods made visible by the setting of the sun. And in this came another thought, that the sun, representing ego, representing selfness, representing, in a way, the light of reason, while it shines, the great God is not seen in all his splendor. The heavens become merely background to the light of the sun. But when the sun fades, the heavens come forth again, and the grandeur of the eternal once more shines down from all the points of light in the sky. Psychologically, then, the essential idea is that this totality gradually passed from the consciousness of man to be buried in the particulars of his own interests and observations. The great God was no longer the sky dweller. He was no longer the being remaining forever, sustaining and moving all things. He became rather the neighbor, the close one. He came to be the present help in time of trouble. His powers were invoked by men, and this deity was believed to be able to answer all of these prayers, and from his great celestial universality could descend even to nourishing the particular and peculiar desires of mortals. Thus something happened, and this thing that happened was that the supremeness of consciousness represented by this deity gave place to the limitation of ego, the rise of selfness both in heaven and in man. And the selfness in man resulted in the emergence of the self-hero in heaven. The rise of individuality, individualized deity, as far as human experience was concerned. This again became a very important factor in the gradual rise of systems. Now another point that Pike makes a great deal of is the emergence at a comparatively early time of groups, classes, or peoples, not only in the term of a great migration, but in the term of the common life of man,